Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Buzzardview Manor. I have a very special guest this evening. It's Judas S. Wacko, and he's here to tell us about this project that he's been working on. He has a background in film, and he'll also be sharing that background with us. So, everyone, welcome our guest, Judas.
Yay! Thank you. Thank you so much, Lady Winters. Miss Lana, Lady Winters, I really appreciate you having me on. It's funny. I've been called Judas by a lot of people, like even Judas Iscariot. It's Jude, like, hey, Jude. But it's my middle initial is S, so people call me Judas a lot. And the funny thing that your viewers may want to know is I used to be in the seminary to be a priest a long time ago. So, you know, like in a former life. And I went completely opposite. Now I'm like into horror stuff, but I think, so that's why people call me Judas a lot.
And I think that's so interesting. I just feel like, and this is just my opinion again, I feel like a person can have faith, a person can be religious, and you can still like horror. Like, I am a person of faith, you know?
That's great.
But I also believe that there's room for the arts. And to any of my brothers and sisters out there who are from the walk of life that I come from, that walk of both, never let anyone make you feel ashamed for appreciating and liking the things that you like. There's no demons coming through the TV for you. So, okay.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Yeah. So I used to, you know, I came from a background, I grew up in Georgia. And when I was high school age, I went to two seminaries, high school seminaries, and then a college seminary before I eventually went to the University of Georgia. But in my formative years, you know, I was in these old seminaries that were, some of them were 200 years old. One was in Princeton, New Jersey, and one was in off of Lake Erie in Pennsylvania. And they were super creepy old buildings that had all this history, you know, like you would picture Harry Potter, or if you've ever seen that Robin Williams movie, Dead Poets Society. They look like those kind of buildings, right? Those old stone buildings, and up there it would snow in the winter, and, you know, it just, you go through all the seasons. So I think that really sparked my creativeness at a very young age, because I was living in this like surreal world surrounded by all this symbology. And, you know, it was a Catholic seminary, so it had all that background. It had the history of the school and all the priests and nuns that had been through there, and brothers and seminarians, and hundreds of years, you know, like the place had been used in the war, and all kinds of stuff like that. So had a lot of history. And, you know, at night we would study way up in the top, like on the seventh floor. This is a massive complex. But we would sleep in the basement, oddly enough. The showers and the bunks, you know, it's kind of military style. It's all boys, obviously, for a priest seminary. And so we would study late at night till whatever, 2 a.m, you know, cramming for these exams, because, you know, they were very strict about education. And then we'd have to go down through these creepy hallways with all these statues and, you know, just 100-year-old buildings and all these ghost stories about, you know, demons and people getting chased to the altars and all kinds of stuff. And that never, you know, sort of left my psyche. And I think it sparked a lot of interest in all those things. Cause I still, to this day, I'm almost 50, and I still have dreams about that seminary and sort of like that sort of surrounding of these almost castle-like surroundings, you know? So I think that's a big part of it, probably.
Very medieval gothic mastery of like mason work. I mean, totally. I think that place must have really left an impression, because I think that when we have reoccurring dreams of places that we've been in the past, it's left an imprint in our mind and our soul. And there is something probably about that place that really opened that artistic level for you.
I totally think so, because, you know, the priests, to their credit there, you know, most of them were like college doctorates. They all had master degrees and stuff, because back then they took the education of priests very seriously. And so they wanted us to have the highest level education. So they taught us at that age, I'm talking, I was like 12, 13, 14, 15, high school age. I was a freshman in high school when I entered the seminary, and I was a sophomore in college when I finally got out of it. But those are like super formative years. And I was being taught things that I would have never been taught in Georgia, you know,
right.
Like, you know, I went to see orchestras and violinists and I went to, you know, Broadway, and it just all these doors were opened up that I never would have gotten in small town Georgia. So it kept sparking my interest. Like, you know, around every corner, I was being introduced to, you know, Johann Sebastian Bach or Mozart or Edgar Allan Poe or Roald Dahl or these, you know, masters of art and literature. And I really, for me personally, I really went over to the art side of things as opposed to the science side. Of course, we were getting that as well, but, you know, just something about my creative brain got sparked there. So I'd say that's probably the beginnings of all my creative stuff. And definitely Gothic horror. I mean,
yes.
If you've ever been in a 200-year-old, you know, seminary, cloister seminary, you walk in and it's all marble and giant crosses and creepy looking statues that are often clothed. And sometimes they have gargoyles and demons, like they have everything represented in those places. And it's, you know, for a young mind, it's very intriguing and it sparks a lot of interest in that kind of thing.
And structures like that have a life of their own. It's just, you know, that you're in the presence of something that's no longer around and that energy is still there, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, it does make sense. It's totally.
So I find that interesting how like religion and the fine arts basically go hand in hand. I've always said that the arts is a spiritual journey, that when you're blessed and you're gifted with being artistic, you're taking something spiritual for your audience, and you're using that craft as a tool to kind of send out into the world. And yes. I think that's where people who are truly gifted connect and you recognize each other.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. You definitely recognize like-minded people and kindred spirits and all that stuff. And I agree with you. I think a lot of religions, it doesn't matter the religion, like that's regardless. Right. It's an expression of creativeness and artisticness. So like if you look at anything, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, occultism, Catholicism, any ism, it's all has its own beautiful artwork, its own mythology, its own deities, its own folklore and myth and wound together with fact. And it's just all, it's super creative, you know, it's like, it's a great creative outlet that, you know, that kind of, I guess, started my journey. And then, you know, as I got older, when I got in the secular world, as we would call it, you know, right, amongst the civilians, right, outside of religious context, you know, I went to University of Georgia, which is complete end of the spectrum. It's one, it's Georgia, two, it's, you know, like big party school, as you would imagine, you know, so it's like fraternities and beer guzzling and football and all the things, like the opposite to what I had in the seminary, in my seminary experiences. So, but I, you know, for me, after I realized I didn't want to be a priest, primarily because of my love of women, that was something that unfortunately didn't match very well with the vow of chastity, but I figured that out. There was other things, you know, but eventually I realized that the priesthood wasn't for me, but I sort of segued into acting because it was a very similar thing. It's like you're in the public eye, you're preaching in a sense, you're on a stage, you're a public speaker. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, in a church saying a mass or if you're on a stage being a character, it's the same thing. You're trying to teach a lesson, or sometimes it's a morality play, or sometimes it's just a point of view. It doesn't necessarily have to have a any kind of context to it, but the idea of sort of being a spokesmodel and a performer, if you will, because a priest is a performer. That's really all they are. You know, they're an utmost performer, and not just a priest, any kind of, you know, person in that kind of job. So it was an easier segue to me. So I ended up in the theater department of University of Georgia. And that's where I learned all the basics before I even got in the film business. I had to learn all the theater stuff, which was a really great program there for theater. They didn't have a film program at the time. They just had a journalism department, and they had what they called the drama department, which was primarily theater, but they wrapped up cinema and some film classes in there. But it was centered around theater. You know, we learned lighting and production design and stuff like that. All the things that would go. I actually learned how to run the pin and flywheel system. You know, the weights in the old theaters, mm-hmm, that you would do. stuff like that. So that was my next segue after the seminary. And by that time, my brain started expanding into, God, there's this whole world out there of art and literature that I didn't know anything about. I just had no idea it existed, you know, because I was too young and I would just, you know, again, I was in a small town in Georgia where those things would just never come up, you know?
Right.
So as my mind expanded, I kind of leaned into classic literature. So, you know, English literature, and then I found the American literature greats, which kind of segues into where I'm at today with my novel, because my novel is based on Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. I mean, that's where the characters come from. So American literature, you know, James Fenimore Cooper and those kind of guys, Washington Irving, and who people call the father of American literature. And, you know, I started with the English side because I didn't even really know there was an American side, and that, you know, and all the English greats, like, you know, all those people, like Charles Dickens and, you know, all Lego, they're miles deep. And then that sort of led me back to Washington Irving and those guys that were cutting edge in their day because they were Americans and there was no literature in America. They were the first ones to do it in America. So yeah, that's how I kind of went from that to that to that.
Okay. So obviously the Sleepy Hollow had a big impact on you growing up.
Absolutely.
What was it, do you think, about that story that inspired you?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just that feeling that people love. Like, even when I used to watch the cartoon as a you know, elementary school kid of the Adventures of Mr. Toad and Ichabod Crane, yes, from Disney, right? And then I think they did a Sleepy Hollow version. But it's just that, the best way I could describe it is it's a feeling of being scared, but in a safe environment, you know, because like with Sleepy Hollow, you knew that you knew it was going to end up well. You knew like no one was going to die, or if they did, you weren't going to really live vicariously through their gory death. Right. But it was still fun being scared. It was fun having this larger than life thing. Like, it's the most heinous thing you could imagine, a headless man that's larger than life on a horse that's larger than life that is chasing you at full speed, throwing flaming pumpkins at you, swinging an axe at you. Like, it's horrifying, but it's like, it's fun, you know. It's like all the reasons that we go to cemeteries and we look for ghosts, and we take little tiny pin lights and we walk through the basements of morgues and old buildings because we like to be scared. It's a very, you know, fun thing to do, as long as you don't feel like you're actually threatened that you could possibly die. I mean, part of the thrill is you don't know what's out there. There could be like a homeless guy in a basement that's going to try to beat you up, or there, you could get arrested for trespassing by the cops, right, or, you know, or you could get a real scare from, you know, maybe there is some poltergeist activity or whatever. But I think that's why I liked The Horseman, because, and it always came with Halloween, which of course, you know, in America, at least, that's just such a fascinating time of year where there's just this, everyone's kind of up to mischief and there's pranks going on and everything's a little bit scarier. The air is a little colder. The seasonal treats are coming in, you know, people are kind of getting in the mood to party because they know the other holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, are not too far off. So it's just like, it's that nice time of transition where, you know, it's like something's in the air. There's a little, yes, something spooky in there. And ever since as a kid, I think a lot of people can relate to that feeling of that anticipation of the season. And now as adults, with, even though we have tons of responsibility and full-time jobs and kids and spouses and whatever, real responsibility, we still long for that, those feelings, you know, like that, we miss that sort of naivete of being a young kid on the verge of Halloween, knowing we're going to get scared, but knowing we're going to have fun, knowing we're going to be rewarded with treats, knowing ultimately we're protected from everything, but we're going to get the shit scared out of us at some point, you know? So that's why I like The Horseman. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a good reason. Like, I've always said, like, when like summer happens, we enter like the early beginning of fall, and then all of a sudden here's October, right? It, yep, feels like there's this peace that kind of just creeps in, and everything feels soothing, And yes. then everything slowly starts to feel magical as you feel the change in the air. Like you can feel yeah. it in your heart and in your yeah. soul. Okay.
Totally. Yes.
And then so all this stuff is happening like in the world and in life. But what's so special about Halloween in October is you feel like you're coming back to life. But as I call it, it's Never Never Land. It's that time that you're young that's again.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
And so I've never really understood the ideology of people having issues with Halloween. It's that one time of the year, no matter how old you are, that yeah. spark of youth, of life is still yeah. there. You know?
Absolutely. Totally. And it also gives people a chance to let their hair down, you know, because it's like, even if, you know, for people like you and me, you probably even more than me, you know, horror is like a lifestyle for you. But yeah. for like, you know, for your average person, you know, they all love those things, but they can only take it in smaller doses. So Halloween's like a perfect time of year when they can sort of shed their inhibitions and their, you know, very strict rules or the rules of society, and they can watch horror movies and they can, you know, they can dress sexy for a night as a witch or whatever, you know, they could go party and they can read a book like The Horseman, you know, that's about people getting their heads chopped off and stuff and not feel like any trauma or out of placeness with it. Cause it's like that time of year, you know? So it's time to be a kid again, just like you said, which is awesome.
And what I find fascinating about Sleepy Hollow is this phantom that's in the dark.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh yeah.
When, just imagine you're on this rural country road by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and you're facing something supernatural that's dark, you know?
Yes. Yes.
So great. I could see the fascination, but there's also this old world goth feeling with the Sleepy Hollow that you don't find in a lot of stories that I think that is just really gravitates people to it. So yeah,
totally. Agreed.
So let's talk about your version.
Okay. All right. So my version, in a nutshell, you know, without any spoilers, I hope you guys go check out the book. It'll be out on October 29th, but we'll tell you all that info later down the road. But my version is a contemporary version. So it takes place, there is actually a Sleepy Hollow, New York. So it used to be called Tarrytown because people would tarry there. They would rest there on their way either from New York City up to what used to be called Fort Orange. So it has a lot of history. It played a huge part in the American Revolutionary War. But nowadays they rename the town Sleepy Hollow because it's where Washington Irving wrote the legend of Sleepy Hollow based on all the feelings he had in that town. And so he created the Headless Horseman in that actual town. So you can go there now and visit it. So anyway, my story takes place today in that actual town. And it's about a young high school age guy. His mother has been a less than stellar mother. He doesn't have a father. His mother has a lot of boyfriends come in and out. He's never really had an authority figure in his life, and he's got some severe issues. You know, he's got some mental problems, some challenges there. He's got medication he has to take. He's a bit of a social pariah. He doesn't know how to fit in just because he's always been that awkward guy that never really got along with anyone. So he's a bit of an outcast. So in our story, he starts to learn about that town, the actual history of that town. And there is a lot of history in my novel that is part of it is to do with the real town. In fact, a major historian whose name is Jonathan Crook wrote the foreword to my book. And he's like, I would call him the preeminent living expert right now on Washington Irving, the Hudson Valley, Sleepy Hollow, and that whole area. He's like a historian. He does children's shows, and he's been, you know, he's very, very popular. So I've read all his books. I studied the area. I did a lot of research. So there's a historical aspect. But in our story, Vincent, this young man, he's always been fascinated with the Headless Horseman, just like I have always been fascinated with the Headless Horseman, and some of our listeners may have as well. So he lives in that actual town. So he starts researching about the legacy of the horseman, what actually happened, how did this character get created and all that. And he starts to go down that road, and it starts to take, he starts to obsess about it because the book takes place during Halloween. So not only is it the time of year when everyone's focused on these kind of events and this thing, but it's his actual town. It's his personal experience. So as he starts to dive down that road, what happens is this major event in the sort of like an H.P. Lovecraftian type thing called the Tritum of the Hallows, when basically the 3 days of Halloween, whatever you call them, Dia de los Muertos or All Saints Day or All Hallows Eve or Halloween or whatever name your culture gives to them. There's those 3 days when the dead can walk with the earth with the living. And in my book, in my version, there's an atonement for sins. So there's these sins of past generations that all these townspeople have done, whatever they may be. And this particular Tritum of the Hallows that happens during Vincent's lifetime, let's say this thing comes around every maybe 25 years or so. Think of Stephen King's It, how it sort of cycles through Derry every 17 years. It's something similar to that. So in this particular version of the Tritum of the Hallows, it's one of atonement. So the cosmos is pissed off. It's one of retribution. There's no saying I'm sorry. It's like, okay, there's going to be death and mayhem because the universe needs to cleanse itself. That's what's happening. And Vincent's in the middle of that. So it's Vincent's personal journey. It's the town's journey of this legend of Sleepy Hollow sort of coming back to life in contemporary modern society, in the actual town that you can go look online and see exactly things I reference in my novel. So you can actually visit it. You can visit the places I speak of in my novel with your own 2 feet, you know, and see them with your own eyes, which is cool if you wanted to take an interactive adventure. And chaos ensues, basically. So that's basically what the novel's about. It's about Vincent's journey and his arc. It's about the town's arc, and it's about this Tritum of the Hallows, Tritum coming back and sort of trying to rectify all that's wrong with the world, a cleansing of the universe, if you will. And those three things collide into one hell of a story centered around the Headless Horseman, essentially. Yeah.
Well, wow. That's very interesting. And so where can people find this book?
Okay, well, I'm going to have it on Amazon. So I will, it's called The Unhallowed Horseman. And you can check it out on social media because I'll have it on my, you know, I have Twitter and Facebook, Instagram, right. So you can find me on there. But on Amazon, there'll be a pre-sales coming up pretty soon. It's going to release on October 29th as an ebook and a paperback, and possibly a hardback, but we're still not sure about that. I'm also going through Ingram Spark. So in theory, it will also be available in some bookstores and other places, but there will definitely be links to buy it online. I also have, if anyone's interested in doing a review, I'm willing to give them a free digital copy in exchange for a review. Like if they put it on their website, you know, they can be good or bad, whatever. I want their honest opinion, but I would be willing to let them read it for free in exchange for a review. Cause I also want people to get the word out and get people to rate it and give their opinions of it, honestly. I mean, all that good stuff.
And for those who follow me, I'll share it. And we'll see if we can get some of these people to do a review for you.
That would be awesome. That would be great. Yeah, totally.
So before I let you go, kind of let our, viewers who are tuning in kind of also let them know your background in film so they know who this man is that's speaking to them. Let them know kind of like your background as well.
Oh yeah, okay, cool. So yes, I have had almost 3 decades of in the film world. I started as an actor, and then I eventually worked in production, starting on this very small jobs like being a PA, but on huge studio stuff for mostly back in that day was 20th Century Fox and New Regency and Universal and those guys. And then eventually, as the world switched over from celluloid film to digital, I started producing, you know, I went up right up the line. So I went from assistant production coordinator, production coordinator, production manager, production supervisor, to associate producer, to co-producer, to producer. And now I'm sort of at the top of that, not at the top of, not the best of the best, but I mean, as far as the title, I'm at the top of, I'm now a PGA, which is Producers Guild America producer. I wrote and directed a film called The Incantation, which some of your viewers may like. It's a horror film that has Dean Cain in it and Sam Valentine, which takes place in a creepy castle in France. We shot it all in France, and that's sort of deals with, you know, a fish out of water American girl goes to France and experiences her relative's castle and some witchcraft and demonology, and crazy things happen and crazy things ensue. So they can watch The Incantation. But I've probably worked on 150 films in some capacity or the other over the past 30 years, and I continue to do so. I always have stuff in development. I have my own projects as well. We're working on a big documentary that has to do with Fallujah right now, for my personal company, which is Blue Falcon Productions. I got tons of scripts and tons of projects. But if you check me out online, you know, you can go on the IMDb and see people always say, Who have you worked with? I mean, I've worked with everybody, you know, I've worked with everybody, but I'd say, you know, like people always say, who's the nicest people. And like my top five are probably, I don't know, Morgan Freeman, Matthew McConaughey, Dean Cain, Jennifer Lopez, like they're Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre. They're just those people like immediately pop out of my mind is just like sweetheart, also business oriented people, but also like down to earth, cool, relatable, awesome. And I know your Texas peeps will love to hear that about Matthew McConaughey. He's probably my number one, to be honest. Like I did a movie with him called Wedding Planner, and I spent a lot of personal time just hanging with him because he ended up for some reason trusting me as production. You know, he kind of latched on to me as like his go-to guy, even though I was supposed to be coordinating.
you know why I think that probably is? I think that when people kind of have their roots in the South, there's something very, very familiar that we're like, oh, you're for real. You're for real. Like, I like you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely that thing, you know, like we say, you know, he's good people. And that I think you recognize that right away in someone. And the South comes with, as much shit as people talk about the South, it comes with its own values and morals and community and things you can trust about it. Those of us who grew up there.
Right.
And yeah, you're right. I think Matthew, you know, I, if I got time, I'll tell a real quick story about him because it's just so cool.
No, go ahead. Yeah. And hey, I do apologize. I asked you about your, you know, your history, and then I have my golden doodle going off in the background. I'm so sorry. I'm like, oh.
It's awesome. So anyway, I did Wedding Planner with Matthew McConaughey and Jennifer Lopez in San Francisco. We shot out of the Western Hotel, and you know, it was a $60 million budget, which is a big budget back then. You know, nowadays it's either 200 million or 30, but back then that was a big budget. But anyway, so, and I was just the, you know, like I was the assistant production coordinator, which is basically a secretary. That's what I was in realistic terms. I was a production secretary essentially. But like I said, I got to know Matthew and I worked with him a lot. And then like 4 years later, I was in LA. And he was doing that dragon movie. I can't even remember the name of the movie, but I know he shaved his head for it because he was bald. It was some dragon movie he did that never did anything good. It was horrible. But anyway, I was in, it was like some fancy hotel that I did not deserve to be in, like the Four Seasons, because I was having lunch with someone, you know, like I was totally out of place. I looked like a redneck Georgia guy, ripped jeans, you know, baseball cap, beard, but I was there having lunch with someone else. And I saw Matthew there with a shaved head, and I called the maitre d' over and I go, hey, can I buy that guy a beer? And the maitre d' was like, we don't do that here. So like he looked at me and he knew it was Matthew McConaughey, and he was like, no, we don't do it. Like, no fanboys here. Right.
Yeah.
And right. I was like, no, I know him. I just want to buy him a beer. Like, I don't want to mess with him. I don't even want to interrupt him. Just buy him a beer and that's it. And the guy was adamant, no, not happening. And I was like, okay, cool. You know, I'm fine. Like, it doesn't bother me. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
So in that restaurant, there's a glass, I don't know what you call it, foyer or whatever, like in the middle of the whole restaurant could see it. And you, in order to go to the restroom, you have to go through this glass like entryway. So it's sort of the restaurant is built around this glass thing in the middle. So I went to the restroom. When I come out, Matthew McConaughey is like drinking wine with his buddies, smoking cigars in the middle. And I walk out of the restroom and he throws up his hands and he's like, Jude, what are you doing here, man? Oh my God, so good. He pulls me over, grabs a cigar out of his mouth, puts it in my mouth. You got to try this cigar. It's the best Cuban you ever had. Dude, try this wine. It's great. So he's like doing all this stuff and he's like telling all his buddies. He's like, hey, this is Jude, man. We were in San Francisco, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, in front of the whole restaurant can see this, right? So then I go sit back down and I'm like turning like 8 shades of red and trying to finish my meal. And I'm like, oh my God, that was so embarrassing, but so cool. And then the maitre d' came over and he goes, I am so sorry. He's like, oh, we're going to comp your meal because I had no idea. And I was like, you know, again, it was just a little meek thing. And I was like, yeah, man, I was saying, I just wanted to buy the guy a beer. Like I know he likes Amstel Lights, you know, but that the moral of this story is Matthew McConaughey is awesome. Cause like I was really nobody. Like, and even if I was like, he didn't have to recognize me. He didn't have to do anything. Like he could have just said, oh yeah, I remember that guy, you know, screw him. But he's the exact opposite. He's such a sweetheart of a person. So he's definitely my top 5 Hollywood A-listers that are just amazing. So and there you go, Texas.
That right there, what he did, that is the true Texas mentality of people who are true natives. Like, it doesn't matter who you are, what you do, or your title. You're like, hey, you're my equal. We're family.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. That's how it is. Yeah. I love that about people there. You know, I do. So, yeah. Cool.
So, well, you know, thank you for hopping on and sharing your story with us, and hopefully we can get people out to check out your book.
Yeah, no, thank you. I really want to thank you for your time, and please check it out, because if you're a horror fan, if you're a Halloween fan, if you're a Sleepy Hollow fan, I guarantee you, you'll enjoy the ride. You will have a fun time. It's a good read. It's a horror one, and I won't let you down. I promise. It'll be worth your time. I wouldn't pitch it otherwise if I thought you were wasting your time.
Well, I believe you. We believe you. Yeah.
Cool.
All awesome. Right. Well, thank you and have a wonderful evening. Okay.
Awesome. You too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Bye.